Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Jackie Hendry, in today for Lori Walsh. Thousands of people around the country are participating in protests against police brutality and racism after George Floyd died after an officer kneeled on his neck for more than 8 minutes during an arrest. Some of the demonstrations have turned violent, both with property destruction and looting, and police response with tear gas and other suppression tactics. Some journalists have been detained while reporting on the events, and it raises plenty of legal questions. Here to help us sort it out is Neil Fulton. He is the dean of the University of South Dakota School of Law. Dean Fulton, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for the opportunity, Jackie. Glad to be here.
So we're going to get to some of the legal questions around protesting and other demonstrations that we're seeing. But first, I want to start with some of the potential solutions to the issue that Governor Noem pointed out. I think it was last week in a press conference, and one of those being reconsidering this idea of qualified immunity. And I imagine a lot of folks may not know off the top of their head just what that means. Can you explain qualified immunity to us?
Yeah, qualified immunity is a doctrine that recognizes for certain types of public officials, in particular police, that your actions can't give rise to liability unless they violate clearly established statutory or constitutional rights. Now, the reason that doctrine was created was you have public officials who have to make either decisions in the moment, like police, or decisions in areas where there's great discretion and lack of clarity, like elected officials. And so we want to give them some room for honest mistakes. Where, you know, you really hear people having trouble with the doctrine of qualified immunity right now is this idea of what's a clearly established right. The courts of appeals across the country haven't achieved perfect clarity on that. And in some instances, there have been courts that have said it's got to be exactly the conduct that the officer engaged in. I heard the example the other day of the use of a police dog, and that if it wasn't in exactly the same physical location as had been addressed before, qualified immunity applied. And I think that's where people really start to have problems with the doctrine.
Right. What if we were to say not lean on qualified immunity anymore as it comes to police actions, I know we're dealing in hypotheticals with that, of course, but what do we risk or what do we see if we don't have qualified immunity?
Well, I mean, certainly one of the things you have is that law enforcement agencies and individual law enforcement officers are subject to a greater degree of liability. That can be addressed in a lot of ways. South Dakota, for example, self-insures its state and local officers, and the state would have to assess just the financial cost of that. But there's also the impact on does it make officers in settings that are unclear hesitate to act in instances that make people unsafe? Mm. Clearly, the flip side of that is in some of the instances where qualified immunity is out there and very robustly enforced, it's leading officers to act with impunity. I mean, I think we're seeing examples of that where people are pointing to officers who their perception is don't really feel scared, responsible for their actions. And I think striking that balance, if we're going to reassess qualified immunity by statute, is going to be the real challenge.
Another thing kind of being reassessed in many ways right now is even the existence of a police force. Some Minneapolis City Council members are committing to vote to disband the police department there. Tell us a little bit about kind of the statutory angle on that. Are we legally required to have a police force?
No. I mean, there's nothing that would require us to have a police force, fire department, other entities that provide public safety. Those are choices we make as a society, in fact, create by statute or ordinance. What you've seen in a lot of instances where people are talking about, quote, disband the police, close quote, I think in a lot of instances probably more accurately described as re-envision or restructure the police. One of the most prominent examples is Camden, New Jersey, that a few years ago actually did disband by ordinance its police force. What it then did is work with the county and surrounding areas to develop a new regional policing entity that had greater financial resources, greater training opportunities, greater coordination, And when it disbanded, it let all of its officers go, and the vast majority were rehired. So I think for a lot of folks, there's a discussion about disband, maybe reassess, restructure. And I think for some of the protesters that are out there talking about disband, some of them are also talking about re-envision. Can you have different priorities of what we ask police to do? In many instances, police are frontline folks to deal with mental health issues, to deal with addiction issues. Are there ways to restructure those responsibilities and give them to counselors or addiction advocates who may be better aligned to dealing with those things? Certainly, there are some protesters right now who it appear are just so frustrated and angry that they're really just saying disband the police. But I think that that conversation at a policy level is really talking about restructuring or re-envisioning policing.
Right. And it sounds to me this will largely come down to a very localized decisions. Am I understanding that right?
Absolutely. Law enforcement is really a very localized thing. I mean, individual municipalities make decisions about their law enforcement. They make decisions about how their police is structured, how their police is trained. I think one thing that you see in South Dakota that I really think is better is there's a lot of coordination about our training. There's a lot of centralized training through the Department of Criminal Investigation and the Law Enforcement Training Center. And so we get a lot of our local police forces on the same page about best practices and safety and community engagement, but those are still local decisions that individual municipalities make.
I want to shift our conversation now back to kind of the legality surrounding protests and large assemblies like that. Just kind of to kick us off, what do you think people need to understand about their legal rights to protest that maybe aren't so clear to the average person who's wanting to get involved right now?
Yeah, I mean, not so clear is true for the legal experts, too, because this is really an interesting question that's at the heart of First Amendment law, which is, you know, the division between speech and action. If you go read the First Amendment, it talks about make no law prohibiting speech, and the same is true in our state constitution. But the reality is a lot of the things that we protect under the First Amendment aren't strictly speaking speech. We protect a lot of expressive actions. Burning a flag is protected. Writing is not strictly speaking speech, but it's clearly protected under the First Amendment. So I think one of the key things that people have to realize out there is one of the things that's going to be in play is when action that's expressive crosses over and is no longer protected speech. And I think the easiest way to think about that is if you are out truly trying to communicate, if you are marching, if you are carrying banners, if you are chanting, those are expressive protected acts of speech. But it crosses the line when we move into violence or destruction of property. Those are actions that simply aren't protected. And I think that's the real dividing line for folks out there, is the right to peaceable assembly and expression is what's going to be protected. Violence and property destruction don't have legal protection.
Right. And that touches into my next question. We're hearing the word riot thrown around. When we talk about property destruction and other things like that, that would be probably included in what we imagine as a riot. Is there like a lawful definition of when a protest turns into a riot, or is it based on the individual actions that happen?
Yeah. So in South Dakota, there is law on this, and the place you'd want to go in the South Dakota Code is Chapter 22-10. That specifically deals with riot. And we define riot as when three or more people get together without legal authority and either use force or violence or engage in the threats of force or violence with the immediate ability to carry them out. So if you have a group of three or more people who are together and they start engaging in property damage, or they start engaging in physical violence towards other people, you have crossed the line from protest and expression into riot and criminal activity. Along the same lines, one thing that people need to know in that chapter is a peaceful protest that engages with law enforcement or other public safety officials there is a provision at 22-10-11 that talks about intentionally disobeying a reasonable public safety order to move, disperse, or refrain from specific activities. So if you have, for example, a protest that is going on and there's a reasonable decision made by the police or the fire department or National Guard officials that either certain engagements with, say, counter-protesters or certain actions that are making it unsafe because you have too many people congregated in one area and they ask for people to spread apart or stop doing certain things, that too can give rise to criminal liability.
Huh. How much is reasonableness in the eye of the beholder in that kind of situation?
You know, reasonableness is a central thread that runs through the law. We assess a lot of things for reasonableness, and reasonable conduct is permissible and unreasonable conduct is not. After a quarter century in the law, one thing I can tell you is that reasonable is exactly in the eye of the beholder, but generally it's assessed from the perspective objectively of, we use the reasonable individual as kind of our benchmark, right? So we get in a really circular argument, but it's kind of what most of us would see as appropriate and responsible under the circumstances. So I think when you talk about a reasonable public safety order, if law enforcement simply said to an otherwise peaceful protest, you guys need to go home, that would not be a reasonable public safety order. If a certain number of protesters were pressing in to a confined space such that it's making it not safe for the protesters themselves, or if they were confronting a group of counter-protesters and there was some sense that the situation could become violent and they asked them, hey, can you guys go to opposite sides of the street, for example, that's something that most of us would see as a reasonable order because you're not really prohibiting or interfering with the right of those folks to express, but you're encouraging them and asking them to do it in a way that reflects the safety and protects the safety of everyone involved and gives everyone involved an opportunity to engage in their own expression.
So, of course, we're talking lawful, unlawful, but another question I have is, what's the role of civil disobedience in situations like we're seeing today?
You know, civil disobedience is a really deeply ingrained idea in American society. It goes back to Thoreau and beyond. I mean, Thoreau wrote about the idea of civil disobedience. When we talk about civil disobedience, I think at a philosophical level, what we're really talking about is the idea that some laws or some circumstances in society are so unjust or inappropriate that it is not appropriate to live under that law, that there is a higher responsibility that you as a citizen or as an individual are called to. So, you know, whether it was Thoreau and his essay, whether it was Martin Luther King leading nonviolent protest in the South against segregation, it is saying that these laws are so unjust or inappropriate that we're not going to follow them. One of the real questions then becomes what happens. You certainly saw that in protests against segregation, that folks would carry the consequence of violating the law. They knew they were going to go to jail, but it was the attention that was drawn to the reality of thousands of people being arrested and subjected to laws that were fundamentally unjust that drew our attention to that, and we decided as a society no more. I think one of the real problems becomes that people refer to a lot of things as civil disobedience, and it's not intended philosophically to be simply a protection to do what you want. It is something more than that.
I'm going to end somewhat selfishly on this last question because it relates to journalists. We've seen some videos of these demonstrations, some clearly identified journalists being arrested or facing other action from police officers as they're reporting on these protests and riots. What's the line for journalists?
Yeah, so, I mean, journalists have obviously a First Amendment right as well to report, but they, just like other citizens, are subject to the ability of law enforcement to protect for safety, to clear certain areas, to direct folks to disperse. So I think one of the big things for journalists is they don't have a higher right to occupy certain areas. The law enforcement can ask them to step back for public safety, to report from certain areas. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very practical question for journalists that you encounter, because making sure that you are identified clearly as a journalist is key. In some of these instances where things turn violent, it becomes very easy to have folks not know who's there, and for the journalist to be confused with protesters or with folks who are engaging in violence. So I think that's real key. Clearly, there have been instances we've seen on video where journalists are identifying themselves and police are engaging in conduct towards them that does not, at least to me, appear to be appropriate. That's pretty different from the instances when law enforcement's trying to clear an area and maybe a journalist gets arrested or pushed back by mistake, and it's an honest mistake.
My guest has been Neil Fulton. He's dean of the USD School of Law. Dean Neil Fulton, very interesting conversation. You almost make me want to go to law school. But in lieu of that, I hope you come back again and join us again sometime soon. I really appreciate your time today.
Well, we'd be glad to have you at the law school. I told the law students the other day that regardless of what's going on in our society, it's going to be decided in boardrooms and legislative committee rooms and in courtrooms across the country. So our lawyers will have, you know, something to say about what our future looks like. We'd be glad to have you be one of those future lawyers, Jackie.
Well, thanks so much for your time again.